Welcome to this Banking and Financial Services webinar on the EU's Financial Services Passport. We are recording this webinar on the 13th of October 2020, and so our conversation will be based on the law as at this date. My name is Alistair Holt, and I'm a partner in the financial regulation team at Linklaters. I'm joined by Simon Treacy, a managing professional support lawyer in the same team at Linklaters London office. Today, we'll be looking at the EU's framework for passporting and why it matters for the European financial services sector. There's been a lot of interest in this topic, particularly in the context of Brexit, and we'll return to that later. So Simon, to kick things off, would you like to give some background on what passporting means in the context of financial services?
Thanks, Alistair. Well, if you look back through the history of the European Union, the financial services passport is actually a relatively new concept. But what it does, it builds on some of the fundamental concepts of the single market, specifically two of the famous four freedoms, that is the freedom of establishment and the freedom to provide services, which are both provided for at treaty level. And what these freedoms do is they allow businesses to establish themselves and provide services across the single market within the EU. Now, these freedoms are fine in theory, but going back 30, 40 years or more, national member states' policy towards the regulation of financial services might actually have prevented or presented obstacles to these freedoms being exercised in practice. So what we've seen over the last few decades in particular is a process towards EU-wide standards. And what these have done in financial services is to pave the way towards effectively mutual recognition. And then that in its essence is the origin of the passport. It's built around this idea that the EU has a common rule book for regulation. That is an agreed set of standards which is applied consistently across the market. The upshot of this is that if you are appropriately authorized in one member state, then you should be able to do your regulated business in another member state as well. And this has a huge advantage because that means that firms wouldn't have to seek separate licenses in every single EU member state in which they want to do their business. But instead, they can leverage their authorization that they have from their home state regulator, and they can use this as their passport to go and do business with other clients across the EU. So as it says on the slide, there are a couple of types of passports, and we'll refer to these throughout our conversation today. There's the cross-border passport, and this allows you to provide services from where you are based, which is known as your home member state, and you provide services from there into another member state. Alternatively, there's the branch passport, and that allows you to go and set up shop in another member state and provide those services in person from a local establishment. It is also possible for certain products to be benefiting from the passport, and in particular when it comes to their distribution. And I think, Alistair, we might come back to that shortly. But before I turn back to you, Alistair, just wanted to note that although I've been talking just now about the European Union, it is important to remember that actually the passport extends slightly further than that. In fact, it extends throughout the whole of the EEA. So provided that the legal formalities have been dealt with and that the relevant directives have been incorporated into the EEA agreement, actually passport rights cover the EU plus the other EEA jurisdictions, that's Norway, Iceland, and Liechtenstein. So that is a very broad brush introduction to some of the things that we're going to be talking about and what the passport means. So Alistair, do you want to pick up the thread and maybe build on that by talking about who is it that can actually benefit from these passport rights and what activities they can passport?
Thanks, Simon. Yes, of course. So there are a variety of different European directives, so pieces of legislation, which cover different types of financial services and products. And those directives can allow firms of different kinds to passport around Europe where they're already authorized, licensed in their home member state. So what sort of businesses and products can benefit from passporting rights. So perhaps the most famous or the big ticket one is the passporting regime for banks contained in the Capital Requirements Directive, so CRD4 or shortly CRD5. And this allows banks to passport a variety of different products and services, including deposit taking, so to offer savings accounts and current accounts, payment services, so where a bank offers a current account, it can provide for payments to go into and out of that account and for money to be transmitted to third parties. That is a licensable activity and that can be passported. And of course, lending activity. So lending whether to individuals, so consumer credit, or to institutions and companies, wholesale lending, those activities can benefit from passporting rights under CRD4. Banks can also passport in accordance with the MiFID directive. And the MiFID directive applies to investment firms. So this is asset managers, broker dealers, broadly firms that provide services relating to securities like bonds and shares, derivatives and units in investment funds. And those services could include things like providing advice on those products. It could be making a deal happen in those products, so receiving and transmitting an order. It could be actually executing, but binding a client to a contract to buy or sell securities. Or it could be dealing on an account, so where a firm wants to gain an exposure on its own balance sheet to shares or bonds or derivatives. All those things fall within MiFID, as do capital market type activity. So if you're a company wanting to issue your own shares or bonds, you would ask an investment firm, like an investment bank, to be your underwriter to agree to buy the shares if no one else does. And in the first instance, to try and place your bonds or shares with investors. And those things all fall within MiFID, as do operating certain types of trading facilities. And all those services relating to bonds, shares, derivatives and funds that we've just touched on can be passported pursuant to the MiFID directive. So that in practice can benefit firms which provide only investment services like MiFID asset managers and broker dealers, but can also apply to banks, so entities that accept deposits and make loans, which also do investment services as well, because banks can passport under MiFID or passport the services under MiFID as well as the services under CRD. So Solvency II, this relates to insurers. So these are both general insurers, so firms that insure against risk, against property, against your home, your car, your business and the like, as well as life insurers, so firms that provide insurance against the risk of death or long-term savings products and annuities which pay out after your pension. So insurance act underwriting, so taking the risk of having to pay out under a policy to a policyholder, that's a regulated activity across Europe. But the Solvency II directive allows insurance underwriters to get authorised in one jurisdiction, but to passport the underwriting activity throughout Europe, either in each case by establishing a branch or by providing cross-border services. And the same is true of the banking and MiFID directives as well. The insurance distribution directive, that relates not to the insurance underwriters per se, but rather to anyone who is distributing an insurance product. So insurance brokers, which could be a specialised insurance broker. It could be a bank that's distributing or selling insurance products underwritten by a third-party underwriter. And in some cases, this directive can apply to an underwriter distributing its own products. And again, this provides that if you're an insurance middleman, like a broker, you can set up branches in other jurisdictions throughout Europe or sell products cross-border. The Alternative Investment Fund Managers Directive, AIFMD, is that relates to funds that are not targeted at retail clients. So we're talking hedge funds, private equity funds and the like. And managing those funds and marketing those funds is a regulated activity. But this directive allows the managers of those funds to passport their managing and marketing activities throughout Europe. The UCITS directive is similar, but that applies to retail funds, so funds that invest in safer more liquid types of assets. And that directive provides a passport for the managing activity for the manager doing the fund. So it can manage multiple UCITS funds in multiple jurisdictions based on one authorization. And it also provides a passport at the product level. So Simon mentioned that certain of the passporting regimes, while they generally apply to the firm providing the service, sometimes they can apply to the products. In this case, the product is the fund. And there is a marketing passport which can allow a fund to be marketed to investors in multiple EEA jurisdictions. There's also passporting regimes for example, mortgage intermediaries, mortgage brokers under the Mortgage Credit Directive, and under the e-money directive and the payment services directive. So this would be relevant to, for example, Revolut, which is an e-money firm in the UK and is planning to set up an e-money firm in Ireland. That's relevant to its core service, which is sort of prepaid cards and payment services. So Revolut entities can passport around Europe in respect of their e-money service and their payment services offering. And that enables them to reach the entirety of Europe based on one regulatory license. So a few principles underpin this. One is that only EEA firms are eligible for the passport. So you have to be established and authorized in one of the EU 27 member states or one of the other three EEA states, which Simon mentioned earlier. If you're a firm incorporated in, say, the UK post-Brexit or the US, or Asia, then you as a legal entity will not be able to benefit from the passports. Another principle is that not all the services which are subject to these directives, which we mentioned earlier, are uniformly regulated across the EEA. So for example, under the CRD directive, you can passport wholesale lending, but in a lot of EU member states, wholesale lending is not regulated at all. Whereas in other, or about half of the other EEA jurisdictions, wholesale lending is regulated, so there is a mismatch. But broadly, there is harmonization of standards across these regulatory rules, but there can still be some divergence based on some member states interpreting the rules differently or topping up the conduct rules that apply. The final principle here is that some financial services are not currently subject to a passporting regime. So a good example is acting as a depository, which is basically like a custodian of an alternative investment fund, so holding their assets. Currently, you just have to pick one jurisdiction where you want to get authorized and provide that activity, and you can't passport it around. And I should also say that likewise, this is not necessarily a fixed list of services which can be passported, but it has evolved over time. And currently, as of the date of this webinar, there are proposals at the EU level to introduce passporting rights for European crowdfunding service providers and also crypto asset service providers. So Simon, let's turn back to the passport in practice. What is the process for getting a passport?
Well, Alistair, I think the main point to note is that it is a notification process. So the idea here is that there should be less admin and fewer regulatory hoops to jump through than a wholesale license application in the host jurisdiction. It is not, however, automatic. There is a process to go through before you can start exercising your passport rights. So what does that process look like? Well, as I say, it's a notification, and it's a notification to your home state regulator, who then reviews it and passes it on to the host state regulator. Before I explain how long each regulator has to deal with the notification, I'll quickly provide a flavor of some of the things you need to include in your notification, because I think that's helpful to gauge how detailed and extensive this whole process is. So to give an example, let's say that you want to notify your regulator that you want to set up a bank branch in another EU member state. Here is some of the information you would need to provide. First of all, there's certain pro forma information, including where you're based, where you intend the branch to be, contact details, and so on. And then you get onto the more meaty stuff. There's a business plan you need to provide for the proposed branch. And you also need to explain how that business plan and strategy fits and contributes to the strategy of the entity and potentially the broader group as a whole. You also need to describe your target market for the branch. And of course, you need to list the regulated activities that you intend to carry out from that branch. So specifically, which of those activities that Alistair, you just ran through, which of those you are planning to perform from the branch and so need your passport to cover. And then moving on, you also need to provide plenty of information about the structural organization of the branch and the entity. So that's detail about the relevant reporting lines, your governance arrangements, your risk management arrangements and procedures, information about control mechanisms, AML compliance, outsourcing arrangements, and so on and so on. And finally, there's other information you should provide as well, including financial forecasts, information about any deposit protection schemes, and also IT arrangements and so on. So there's a flavour of some of the things you need to provide, not exhaustive. So as you can tell, hopefully from that list, it's not a full licence application, but there is still a process which needs to go through and requires plenty of planning to happen internally before you can submit the form. In our experience, these notifications can run up to hundreds of pages or actually be relatively thin. A lot depends on how significant the entity is and, of course, the approach of the relevant regulators. So what do those regulators do with the form and what happens next? Well, when you submit the form, actually the slide indicates the overall timeframe for what happens between the date of submission and the point at which you can start to provide services. For cross-border services, the home state regulator forwards the notice of intention to the host state regulator within 1 month of the notification being assessed as complete and correct. Then the applicant firm will be able to commence its cross-border activities once the notification has been received by the host state regulator. For branch passporting, the home state regulator has 3 months to consider the notification, deemed to commence when the notification is assessed as being complete and correct. By the end of that period, the home state regulator must either send a notification to the host state regulator or refuse to do so, providing reasons. The host state regulator then has 2 months after receiving the information to prepare for the supervision of the branch and consider the conditions that may apply. It may apply to the activities that are then carried out in the host member state. The firm may establish its branch and commence its activities when either it receives communication from the host state regulator or when 2 months have elapsed without it receiving that communication, whichever is earlier. So that's an overview of what the process for getting a passport looks like. But why bother going through that process? What are the upsides for firms? Alistair, why don't you pick that one up?
Thanks, Simon. So there are some massive advantages of the passporting regime. And the key thing here is that effectively you only need to become authorised once in your home member state. So to obtain full authorisation is a much more onerous process than the process that Simon just described for passporting. And in some cases, it's really quite hard to convince the regulator to give you a licence. And if you didn't have a passporting regime and you wanted to do business in each of the other 29 states in the EEA, then you would potentially have to go to each regulator in each of those member states across the EEA and say, please, can I apply for a regulatory license application? And you would have to go through a full licensing application and engage with each regulator, which could really be pretty onerous. And in many cases, they might require you, depending on the type of business that you're planning to do, to use a separate legal entity for each license in each member state that you're applying for. And that would be really time consuming, be really burdensome. You'd have to, you know, you would have to give those regulators confidence that each legal entity has the right resources, the right infrastructure, the right people, the right business plan, the right compliance framework to do business in that jurisdiction. So it'd just be quite horrendous. And you would also, to the extent that you had a different legal entity in each jurisdiction, have to have separate pools of financial resources or regulatory capital in each subsidiary in each jurisdiction. And that would be massively inefficient because you'd have loads of duplicating pools of capital. So what's the, if that would be the big disadvantage, what's the big advantage of passporting? You just have one, you can just have one legal entity. You've got one pool of capital, much more efficient. Generally, you just have one set of infrastructure, one core set of staff, one core compliance infrastructure and policies, one core business plan for Europe, although it could be tailored for different member states. That's much more efficient. Your costs are going to be lower. You're going to have reduced regulatory burden. And because a lot of the rules, the regulation across Europe are harmonized, then generally you're going to be looking to have an overarching and consistent approach to complying with regulation and selling your products across all of Europe. You're not going to be looking at each country in isolation and saying, you know, let's start from scratch and work out what the rules are and adapting accordingly. So, you know, it's the massive advantages in terms of fewer legal entities, reduced regulatory burden, lower costs, harmonizing your rules and your compliance framework, and also at the same time accessing the entirety of Europe plus the EEA to sell your products and services to. So it really is a fantastic thing if you have access to it. And I say if you have access to it for good reason, because in terms of the potential disadvantages, that there are some, particularly if you are an entity incorporated outside Europe. So if you're incorporated in a third country, like the UK post-Brexit, like the US, like Asia, then actually you can't benefit from this passporting regime because it's only available to entities which are incorporated and authorised within the EEA. And actually, if you are a third country trying to provide your services and products into the European market to EU clients, then you will find your experience of accessing the EU market completely different. You'll find that actually there's quite a lot of walls put up around the outside of Europe, which make it quite difficult for third country firms to service the European market. And that's quite intentional on the part of the EU because it deliberately tried to construct a very broad and deep market within the EEA, so to remove barriers to trade and services within the European Union between member states to make it as efficient and effective to do business as possible. But at the same time, it has erected some barriers around the outside of Europe, which make it harder for outsiders to access the market. So that's one disadvantage, and that whether that's a disadvantage for you will depend on you know, where you're providing services from and where your legal entity footprint is. Another disadvantage is that there can be some inconsistent approaches to regulation across the EU member states. So we said earlier that whilst regulation is generally harmonized, there are some services which are regulated in an inconsistent manner. So for example, wholesale lending to corporates is regulated in some jurisdictions and not others within Europe. And even for services which are always regulated, like investment services under MiFID, so services relating to securities, derivatives, investment funds, those services, there is a common rule book, but each national regulator may have a slightly different interpretation of what the rules are, and it may enforce them or supervise them in different ways. And they may also gold plate or top up those pan-European rules with their own member state rules that increase the burden for firms. So if you're a firm, sometimes you will have to tweak your approach to doing business or selling products and your compliance framework surrounding that, depending on where in Europe you do business, or potentially adopt a leveling up approach where you go for the highest common denominator and apply that regulatory approach across all of Europe. There's also potential for some confusion about which regulator is responsible for supervision and enforcement of the relevant rules. So, you know, there's different EU regulators across all of Europe in each member state. And, you know, you can have a cross-border footprint. So, for example, you could be a German bank and you could have established a French branch of that German bank. and that French branch could be providing services to a client in Belgium. So there you've got three different member states which are at play. And in that circumstance, it's important to think about which regulator is responsible for supervising your compliance with the rules. And that's something that we're going to touch on now with Simon. So Simon, who is responsible for regulating passporting activities?
Well, Alistair, generally the question here for any aspect of regulation is whether supervision and enforcement is the responsibility of the home state regulator or the host state regulator. Once again, the technical answer is found in those single market directives under which you can find the passporting rights. And as always, the devil is in the detail. But as a general rule of thumb, in the context of a branch, organizational matters and prudential matters are reserved for the home state regulator. So that's the regulator in the member state where the legal entity is established. Whereas it's the host state regulator who is responsible for conduct of business requirements. And there's a certain degree of logic or policy rationale sitting behind this. And I guess that's, if you think about it, the entity focused matters like prudential requirements, regulatory capital, organizational matters, compliance frameworks, and so on. You know, they are fundamentally of most interest and of most concern to the regulator in the member state where that entity is incorporated and is based. Contrast that with more consumer protection type questions, which are then going to be of more interest and more relevance to the regulator where the branch is based. Now, this is where we come back, I suppose, to the fact pattern that you just presented, where you have, for example, a German bank with a French branch dealing with a client in Belgium. Because although I said that generally the host state regulator of the branch would be responsible for conduct of business, that's not always the case. And I think that example is a good one to demonstrate this, because it would be our view that under MiFID at least, this is limited, or this rule of thumb is limited to services that are actually provided in the territory where the branch is based. So if in fact that branch provides services from that member state into another member state, it's probably actually doing that via the legal entity's cross-border passport into that third member state. So to apply it to this scenario, if you had that German bank with a French branch and they were dealing with a Belgian client, actually, you'd be looking at the German conduct of business rules under MiFID rather than the French rules. Now, to add another layer of complexity to this, there may also be rules which are determined not by the location of the legal entity or the branch, but in fact determined by where the client is located. So AML requirements is probably a good example of that. Now, in our experience, those are generally harmonized pretty well. So there's a you can have a pan-European compliance framework in place, but it is still something to be aware of. Now, Alistair, you mentioned right at the beginning of this webinar that Brexit has meant there's been a lot more interest in passporting recently. Do you want to run us through what the main implications are of Brexit for passporting?
Thanks, Simon. That's a really important question. What does Brexit mean for passporting? So there is some good news, and that is that Brexit does not impact the operation of the passport within the remaining EEA member states. So if we put the UK to one side, if you're a German or a French or a Luxembourg bank and you're wanting to exercise your passporting rights by setting up branches in other EEA jurisdictions or providing cross-border services to clients which are located in other EEA jurisdictions, then you can continue to rely on your existing passports to do that. And you can, if you want to, apply for new passports to cover your provision of services and your right to establish a branch in those remaining EEA member states. So the passporting regime, as it relates to Europe, or what is now Europe, continues, and it's unaffected. The real impact of Brexit in relation to financial services relates to passporting between the UK and the EEA. So where a UK firm is wanting to passport into Europe, or where a European firm is wanting to passport into the UK. And the key point here is that the existing passports, which go from the UK to the EEA or vice versa, they're going to cease to have effects at the end of the Brexit transition period, which is currently scheduled to expire at the end of 2020, so midnight on the 31st of December 2020. So what will happen there? What are firms doing to enable them to continue to service their clients wherever their clients may be? And this is, of course, the issue of Brexit planning. So if you are a UK legal entity, a UK firm that has EU clients and places of business across Europe currently, then what you will have done, most likely, is to set up a new EU subsidiary, so a new EU legal entity, and got that license, got that authorised, and then used that entity to passport across Europe. Alternatively, you may already have had an EU subsidiary which had a financial services authorization in Europe, in say France or Germany or Luxembourg, Spain, etc. But perhaps that entity was quite small. But now you need to use that entity to do more things across Europe. So you may have been building out that legal entity by expanding the regulatory licenses and passports which apply to it, and also by transferring additional business infrastructure and clients to that legal entity. If you, on the other hand, are an EU firm wanting to service clients in the UK, either on a cross-border basis remotely from the EU to the UK, or via a UK place of business, a UK branch, then the position is somewhat easier, at least in the short term. And that's because the UK have established something called a temporary permissions regime. And this effectively provides some transitional relief for EU firms which have had a UK passport, either a cross-border services passport or a branch passport. And the regime effectively says that if prior to the expiry of the transition period at the end of 2020, you're an EU firm with a UK branch or services passport, then you can opt into the transitional regime, which will allow you to continue to benefit from a UK license, which enables you to do the same things as you could have done and were used to doing via your passport for a period of up to 3 years. At the end of that period, or before, if the regulator comes to you and asks you what you want to do in the longer term, you will have the option either of applying for a permanent license for your UK branch, or potentially, depending on what business you do, to apply for a license for a UK subsidiary, a separate legal entity, or potentially you might decide to give up your UK branch and to test whether it's feasible to provide cross-border services from your European entity to your UK clients without having a license at all, because generally, it's not possible to obtain cross-border licenses for UK business. And whether you're able to provide cross-border services to UK clients without a license will very much depend on what the nature of the services and products that you are providing, what they are, the nature of the clients, are they retail or wholesale, and how that fits into the exemptions that are available under financial services licensing regimes.
Thanks, Alistair. Let's wrap up now with some frequently asked questions. Alistair, what are the things you're often asked about by clients in the context of passporting?
Thanks, Simon. Well, we're often asked about the process of filling in the forms and how to fill them in. So as you said towards the start of the webinar, we've seen clients take differing approaches to the issue of populating the parcels and notification form. And that can vary massively depending on the relative size of the business that they're proposing to undertake via the passport, its complexity, the type of business, and how closely that entity is supervised by its main regulator in its home member state. Where the business is relatively limited and the regulator in the home jurisdiction is relatively comfortable with how that bank or financial services provider generally operates, then we've found that firms can take a relatively light touch approach to populating the passporting form, providing relatively high level details of the client target market, what your business plan is, the extent to which you're going to leverage your centralized infrastructure and resources, who you intend to have on the ground in terms of staff, but not go into loads of granular detail. But where firms are much more intensively supervised by their home member state, and this can be the case often where the home member state is in jurisdictions historically other than the UK, then the process for passporting, where the business is very sophisticated and there's lots of services that are going to be provided by the passport, can be much more intense because the home member state wants to really understand the regulator there, what are you going to do in other jurisdictions, and wants comfort that you're going to have the right people, the right systems, the right controls to provide that business in a compliant and controlled way across Europe. And this is particularly the case where you're setting up branches in other member states. Which staff are you going to have on the ground? Who's going to be your branch manager or your local AML officer? Do they have the expertise to understand that market and control the business? So that's a key thing that we often advise in helping clients prepare their passporting notifications. And related to that, we're often asked to advise, and this is because it's relevant to the passporting notification, what passports do firms need? And that will often involve taking the commercial products and services that the firm offers. They'll have different business lines and they'll have different labels attached to them. And we'll have a role in translating that commercial or those product names into types of regulatory regulated activities and regulated and passporting types, so that we know and we can advise the clients which passports they need to exercise to ensure that they have the right regulatory coverage when they're providing those services in different jurisdictions. Another issue that we often advise on is the issue of cross-border versus branch passports. So you can have both. You can have both a branch passport for France and a cross-border passport to provide services remotely into France. And often it will be very clear whether you need one or the other or both. So for example, if you are intending to have a physical building in Paris with your name over the top of the front door, then it's clear that you've got a branch there and you need a branch passport. If on the other hand, you're proposing to service your French clients from a Frankfurt base and to do that via calls, via websites, via electronic channels, and you're not actually going to be physically in France, then it's clear that you need a cross-border passport for that business. But sometimes the lines can be blurred. So for example, if you have a German product specialist or bankers flying into France and regularly meeting French clients, and let's say that they do this pretty regularly, and they do it for a fairly material amount of time each time, then, and they might be meeting them at the same place all the time. So it could be that they meet them at sort of a serviced office, which doesn't bear the name of the firm, or even in the same hotel lobby, but they're always there every Friday and Monday and providing services to the client. There, it may well be that despite not having the name and an office, the name above the door in an office, actually you would be regarded by the host state regulator, so the jurisdiction where the client is, as having established a place of business, because you're there pretty frequently and the client knows where to meet you and they know that that's where they can expect to receive a service from. So in some cases, you may need to exercise your passporting rights for a branch, even though you haven't got your own office building. And of course, tax and other implications can be relevant to that. So that's an important issue to think about. Another question we've been asked a lot in the context of Brexit is, what about third country branches? So what we mean by this is, if we're an EU entity and we have a branch in a country which is not within the EU or EEA, so for example, a branch in the US or Asia or post-Brexit in the UK, can we provide services from that third country branch, say in the UK, to European clients? And you know, that I can understand why that question would be asked, because you might say, well, the European passport's attached to the European legal entity, and so does that mean that they cover us for all business within Europe, regardless of where the people are providing the service from? But the answer to that, it's been made pretty clear by European regulators, is that the passport for the European legal entity does not extend to branches in third countries. And what that means is that if you are bankers located in the UK branch of the European entity, then you're not allowed to directly service European clients from the UK branch in reliance on the European passport, because the passport is just for services provided within Europe. That doesn't mean that firms don't want third country branches. You could use your third country branches for other reasons. So for example, you could have a London branch to service the UK market, or potentially you could use infrastructure and personnel in the London branch to help provide internal services to the HQ of the European legal entity or to other European branches within that legal entity. But what you don't want is regulated services going directly from your third country branch to European clients, because the European regulators are not going to like that. In terms of upcoming banking and financial services webinars, one date for your diary is the 26th of November, where there's going to be a webinar on digital enhancement principles. Thank you for attending this webinar. We hope you've enjoyed the session.